Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figter, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Cecile Faube. Cecile is senior research fellow in politics at All Souls College, Oxford. She's also professor of political philosophy at the University of Oxford. Her research is focused on central normative questions about justice, cosmopolitanism, and war. Her new book has just been published with Oxford University Press. Its title is Spying Through a Glass Darkly: The Ethics of Espionage and Counterintelligence. Now, on its face, spying and counterintelligence activities seem morally suspect. They tend to involve sneaking, deceiving, and manipulating, as well as various forms of betrayal, treachery, and disloyalty. But intelligence and counterintelligence operations are mainstays of any modern state. Should we conclude that these activities are wrong, but nonetheless necessary, given the realities of modern politics? Now, in Spying Through a Glass Darkly, Cecile Faube develops an intricate account of the morality of spying and counterintelligence activities. She argues that routine espionage activities are morally justified and even sometimes obligatory as a means to thwart violations of fundamental rights. However, she also argues that familiar forms of mass surveillance are unjustified. Now, as usual, there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about here, but let's begin, as we normally do, with our guest. Hello, Cecile. How are you?
Hi, Bob. I'm very well. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine today. It's really nice to talk to you, but we usually begin these interviews with the author of a fabulous new book speaking a little bit about herself. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. First of all, let me thank you for having me on the program. I've looked forward to this, you know, very much. So about myself, well, I'm a moral and political philosopher, currently, as you said, at the University of Oxford. As I'm sure your listeners will have spotted by now and may know already, I'm French, but I've lived in the United Kingdom for 30 years, you know, this year. So I first came over to do a master's degree at the University of York. Then I moved to Oxford to do my doctorate under the supervision of Jerry Cohen. And then I've moved around the UK, you know, quite a bit until I came back to Oxford about 12 years ago. You know, now. As you said, I've worked a lot on theories of justice, cosmopolitanism, the ethics of war. I've also had a long-standing interest in the rights that we have of our own body, and I'm now moving into slightly different, you know, areas. I'm getting very interested in some of the ethical issues that arise from the protection of cultural heritage. On a less serious note, the one that is entirely relevant to what we are going to talk about this afternoon, I'm a massive fan of crime and spy fiction, which is one of the reasons why I ended up writing a book about the ethics of espionage. I mean, the opportunity to read Le Carré's novels and watch The Americans or The Bureau for work was just too good to pass up, really.
You know, it's always, I've been doing this podcast for over a decade. It's always interesting to hear that kind of thing from an author, like what the background is to the interest in the topic that the book was about. That's fabulous. So let's talk about the book. How's that?
That's perfect. Excellent.
Fabulous. So I suspect you get this kind of sort of background question a lot. So, you know, like many political philosophers, I myself, you know, opened your book with a vague sense that some of the canonical political theorists, and I was thinking mainly of a sort of throwaway line in a paragraph or two in Hobbes on the Citizen. But, you know, sometimes you get in classical political philosophy, you get a sentence or two about spies and what to do about them and whether they're needed and, you know, how to reward them and how to keep them loyal and all the rest. But it wasn't until I got into the book that I realized how odd it is that the topic isn't more central, especially in contemporary political philosophy. Now, you know, as you note that in the book, there is a literature about surveillance and technologies that rob us of our privacy, allegedly. But, you know, the practices of spying, again, I suspect you're not alone in being a fan of spy novels and spy films. So it's kind of a puzzle that it's not more central to what political philosophers are doing. So let's begin then maybe with if you have thoughts about why it might not be so central. But then I want to move very quickly into your opening analysis of these sort of three types of approaches that are more or less explicit, sometimes only implicit in contemporary political philosophy, about spying, the dirty hands, contractarian, and just war accounts. So can you give us that background and then get us up and running?
Excellent. So on the background, I mean, I have puzzled over why there is so little about espionage in contemporary political philosophy for years. I mean, particularly in the last 20 years, which has witnessed an extraordinary revival in just war, you know, theory. And as we all know, you know, espionage is a handmaiden of war. So I simply do not understand why, you know, philosophers of war haven't really thought seriously about espionage. I suppose, you know, a partial and somewhat facetious, you know, answer to that question is that in popular culture, we perhaps tend to reduce espionage to James Bond. And it doesn't seem very serious, you know, to write scholarly articles about the ethics of James Bond. I'm not entirely sure whether there is a less facetious, you know, answer to the puzzle. In any event, I realized, having worked and written on the ethics of war for a long time, that I really had to scratch that philosophical intellectual hitch, you know, about espionage, hence the book. Now, as you say, there are broadly three contemporary approaches, which for the reasons I've just given are not very well developed, the dirty hands approach, contractarianism, and just war theory. Although, you know, they are not satisfactory, I want to stress that all three of them tell us something really important about the ethics of espionage, so they are worth investigating, you know, in their own right. So if we start, you know, with a dirty hands approach, it might be helpful first to remind ourselves of what is a classic dirty hands scenario. So a dirty hands scenario is one in which an official, for example, you know, the president of the United States or, you know, the British Prime Minister, is presented quite official with a choice between two courses of action, both of which are morally unpalatable. And he chooses one of those courses of action. So in the classic case, for example, torturing a prisoner in order to find out where the dirty bomb, you know, is located. And in so doing, he dirties his hands. And the reason he does that is that breaching, in this particular case, the moral prohibition on torture is not as bad as allowing hundreds of people to die, you know, at the hand of terrorists. And so in the context of espionage, you know, we could see or argue that intelligence officers dirty their hands to the extent that as intelligence officers, they must choose between, for example, not lying, not betraying, not blackmailing at the cost of being left in the dark, but on the other hand, committing those acts as a means to procure and protect sensitive information about national security. And they choose to do the latter. So on the dirty hands view, they dirty their hands and they do so justifiably, you know, for the sake of protecting lives, you know, by means of protecting information about national, you know, security. Now, you know, on the face of it, this seems to be a very plausible characterization, you know, of what happens. And in that sense, the dirty hands approach is insightful because it tells us that when we think about espionage from a normative point of view, we have to find a justification for tactics, courses of action, which are morally unpalatable. I mean, the problem with the dirty hands approach, however, is that it does not allow for the possibility that the intelligence officer might in fact be acting entirely cleanly. So it seems to me that the presumption of the wrongfulness of, for example, deceiving or manipulating others can be lifted or overridden. And if that is the case, then the intelligence officer, to repeat, does not dirty his or her hands. And it seems to me that we have to be attuned, you know, to that possibility. So that is why I don't find the dirty hands approach entirely satisfactory. Does that make sense so far?
Yes. Yeah, perfect.
Good. And so the second approach that I discuss in the book is what I call, in line with others, contractarian, you know, political morality. Now, it's a little bit complicated to explain because contractarian political morality admits of many different, you know, variants. But the central claim, you know, is this. At the bar of contractarian political morality, the right thing to do is defined by appeal to norms which rational and moral agents either consent to as a matter of fact or would consent to if they were aware of those facts or hypothetically, you know, consent to. So to give you an example, on Hobbes's view of contractarian morality, the consent at issue is the consent of moral agents who realize that it is in their interest to entrust the state with the task of protecting them from internal and external threats. On Locke's view, the consent at issue is the consent of agents who realize that the only way to ensure that all are treated equally is to have each consent to the authority of the sovereign. Now, there is a tradition within just war theory, which constructs the morality of war along contractarian line. And there is also a little bit, you know, of a tradition in the ethics of espionage, which does the same. So, for example, if we go back to Hobbes's view, the thought here is this: it is in the interest of intelligence professionals and the masters whom they serve to abide by certain norms of conduct when they carry out espionage, you know, activities. They either, as a matter of fact, do consent or ought to consent to those norms, and they common agreement on those norms is what gives us, you know, a moral framework for espionage, you know, activities. And, you know, a relevantly similar argument can be made about espionage on Lockean grounds. Now, again, there is something interesting about contractarian political morality, you know, in the context of espionage. It is the kind of framework which, as far as I can tell, is the most often deployed by intelligence officers who have thought and reflected on the ethics of their profession. So another way to put the point is that, as far as I can make out, the professional ethics, you know, of espionage is very much articulated along contractarian lines. And although I do not myself subscribe into contractarian political morality, and I'll explain why in a second, it seems to me that in this field, as you know, in the realm more widely of war ethics, or indeed police ethics, which is similar, it's important to be aware of the ways in which the professionals think, if only because one has a better chance of being listened to by them if one shows that one is aware of the philosophical assumptions on the basis of which they conduct their work. That said, as I noted a moment ago, I am not a proponent of contractarian political morality. For a number of reasons. I mean, let me, highlight two, really. First of all, to be honest, the fact that some political communities and intelligence professionals have developed, shared understandings of what count as acceptable and unacceptable espionage practices, and the fact that they consent to those understandings, it seems to me, does very little to show that those practices, in fact, are morally acceptable. So, for example, in a given political context, the practice of using honey traps to blackmail enemy agents into betraying their country might be regarded as wholly acceptable by an intelligence service, yet condemned, by another. So, to illustrate this particular example more, precisely, in the course of writing the book, I read, vast quantities of empirical materials, and in particular, the autobiography of Marcus Wolf, who was one of the highest ranking intelligence officers of the former Democratic Republic of Germany. And it's absolutely clear in the autobiography that he sees nothing problematic to the use of honey traps, and that he's not alone in endorsing the practice in his intelligence communities. At the same time, I have had former officers of British intelligence agencies swear to me that it is absolutely not part of shared understandings within the British intelligence communities, to use honey traps. So, it seems to me that, contractarian morality would need to have a better grounding for its claim that there is, consent on some of the norms, at issue. My second main objection, in a way, is related, to this. Very quickly, contractarians will have to accept that there are norms of conduct which are valid irrespective of whether or not intelligence professionals and the citizens on whose behalf they act agree to those norms or not. And as soon as they make that concession, it seems to me that the game is up, because then one has to wonder whether, the notion of the contract, and much more deeply, appeals to consent on which contract in theory rests, does any work at all to get us to understand what it is that intelligence professionals are permitted or obliged, to do.
And that's just a more general objection to whatever you want to be a contractarian about, right? It's a good one.
Well, I think it's a good one. I have long-standing disagreements about this, with some of my colleagues, who have developed very sophisticated, accounts of contractarian political morality as applied, to war. But I do stand, by, the concerns I have just, articulated. The third approach is the just war, theory, approach. That's a very, very long, standing, philosophical framework, which, in the West really started being developed by theologians, in the early, Middle Ages. I wonder if I may to spend a little bit of time on this, in case some of your readers are not familiar, with just war, theory. So in the West, the central puzzle, if you are a Christian, is this. Given Christ's injunction against harming, you know, other people. How can one develop an account of self-defense? Right. It is all very well, you know, to say that if I'm hit, you know, on one cheek, I ought to turn the other cheek. Nevertheless, very, very, very few people, and indeed very few Christians, are absolute, you know, pacifists. So in the context of war, you know, the challenge is to provide a justification for the permissibility of killing, you know, within a Christian, you know, framework. And that challenge has been taken up, you know, over the course of several centuries. The answer to that challenge consists in arguing that war is just, all things considered, only if it meets a number of conditions. It has to have a just cause. It has to be waged by the right authority. It has to be a proportionate response to the wrongdoing to which one has been subjected. And once the war has started, there are certain rules about what can or cannot be done. So, you know, the innocent who are not causally or morally responsible for the war are not legitimate targets. Soldiers are, you know, legitimate targets. There is a proportionality condition. You know, once the war has started, the war must have a reasonable chance of success, and it must be the option of last resort. Now, I wanted to spend a bit of time on this because, you know, in the light of what I said at the very beginning of the conversation, that espionage is a handmaiden of war, at first sight, when I started thinking about espionage, I thought, well, it's easy. You know, you just apply, you know, the just war theory framework, and then you have straightforwardly, you know, an account of the permissibility of espionage. And you have it not just within war, but outside of war, you know, as well. So straightforwardly, you could argue that an espionage operation is justified if it has a just cause, if it is proportionate, if it abides by certain norms as to who may be targeted or not, you know, and so on and so forth. So again, you know, the just war theory framework is attractive. It tells us something about how to go about justifying espionage. And the thing that it tells us is that if we have any hope to justify espionage, we have to accept that we need to provide an account of defensive harming, you know, harming in self-defense or harming, you know, in defense of others. The problem, however, is that just war theory, as I've said, is concerned with justifying killing, or at any rate, very serious injury, you know, to limbs and property, as well as threats to life, but at the risk of pointing at the obvious, to spy and to protect one's secrets is not at all the same as to kill. So an account of the ethics of espionage must be very sensitive to this important difference, you know, between those domains of activity.
Right, and I guess that in the espionage case, it would be, since it's so central to just war theory, that there be identifiable categories like aggressor.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Who started it?
In espionage,
it doesn't seem like that's... doesn't seem like that applies in espionage. Who started spying doesn't seem like the right kind of moral, doesn't seem like the same kind of relevant question as it does,
yeah,
in the war case, right?
That's good. So I think you're right. So this is interesting. So the contrast here, picking up on what you've just said, you know, could be framed as follows. Well, look, you know, when we start talking about the morality of war, are we not presupposing that there is a clear contrast between a state of war and a state of peace? And, you know, the norms regulating war are norms for exiting a state of peace and entering a state of war. And by contrast, it seems that, you know, given that espionage goes on all the time,
Even among allies,
amongst allies, it seems that the framework of the just war is not entirely apposite. Now, I'm very sympathetic, you know, to this. However, one of the really serious philosophical and practical and legal, you know, challenges for philosophers of war and lawyers who have to think about war is that in many more conflicts than used to be the case, certainly in the modern and contemporary era, the line between war and peace is really not as hard and fast, you know, as we might think. And so if that's true, then, you know, some of the worries that I articulate in the book about the ethics of espionage, worries which flow precisely from the fact that espionage is an ongoing state of affairs, those worries will also arise for those military conflicts which seem to be, by dint of how protected they are, ongoing, you know, states of affairs as well.
Right. Fabulous. So good. So we've got three accounts. Some of them are merely implicit in literature. Some are more explicit. They reveal something important. The argument is that they are deficient. So your positive account then begins with an insight. I think this is a really sound methodological thought, right? That if we're trying to figure out the morality of espionage, we need to begin with an examination of secrecy, because that's what espionage is always about. More specifically, you argue that members of political communities, maybe political communities themselves in some sense, have a right that certain kinds of information about themselves be kept secret. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, it's a pro tanto right. Can you tell us a little bit about that right to secrecy? Because that seems to me the hinge on which your account sort of turns.
Yeah, good. So before I do that, I think I need to do a bit more work, you know, to explain why I start with secrecy. And I need to do a bit more work there because I can imagine that, you know, some of your listeners might say, well, hold on. I mean, a lot of the information which intelligence agencies gather is publicly available, you know, information. So, you know, to use as an example, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia on the 24th of February, you know, 2022. Well, you know, Western intelligence agencies had known for months that Russia was gathering troops alongside the border. So there was nothing secret about that. It would be odd, however, you know, to describe the activities of those intelligence agencies in the months leading up to the invasion as not being espionage or intelligence, you know, activities. I mean, in a similar vein, you know, some of the information which intelligence agencies gather is portrayed as secret by the other side. But in fact, it's not. I mean, the other side really wants us to have it, for example, in order, you know, to deceive us. But if the other side really wants us to have it, it's not true that intelligence agencies acting for us are in the business of getting information that the other side doesn't want us, you know, to have. So, you know, the relationship between, you know, espionage and secrecy is a little bit more complex, you know, it seems to me, than we might be tempted to think, you know, at first sight. Nevertheless, I do think that that relationship exists. So it's true that a lot of the information that is gathered by intelligence agencies is open source, you know, information. It's available by, you know, satellite, you know, observation, you know, and so on and so forth. That, of course, is entirely compatible with the fact that the other side would much rather that we not have it. I mean, I can imagine that the scenario in which Russia, for example, might have wanted, you know, to hide, you know, the extent, you know, of the military strengths that it was willing and seemed to us to be able, you know, at the time, you know, back in February, you know, to deploy. Moreover, what that publicly available information tells us about the other side might not be something that the other side wants us to know. And finally, when the other side does want us to have that information, when it does so in order to deceive us, well, what we are in the business of really trying to find out is the real information that they do not want us, you know, to have. So secrecy really, you know, is absolutely central, and yet it hasn't really been looked at, you know, by the scholarship on espionage. I mean, it's been looked at in a lot of other contexts, which are germane, but not specifically, you know, in the service of scrutinizing whether espionage is morally permissible. So what I want to argue is that citizens of a political community have a presumptive right that some important information about themselves, qua citizens, so relating to national security, political agency, to their economy, as well as, in some cases, to their private lives, be treated as secret by the other side in the context of foreign policy. So that's how the argument goes.
Right. And so let me ask about the next step then. Because I do want to hear about the basis for that, right? I mean, you've got these sort of two reasons why we might have this, right? But once you the argument, the way the argument works is that once you establish that members of the political community have that right that certain information be kept secret, that's the basis for the defense of espionage as not merely permissible. And here's the part that I thought was really intriguing and very, very interesting about the book, because ultimately you argue that certain espionage activities are not only permissible, they are also obligatory. Yes. So can you fill in some of those gaps?
Well, first, it might be helpful if I say a little bit more, if that's okay with you, about justifications for the right to secrecy, to political secrecy. So, I mean, there are essentially two. I deploy four in the book, but the main ones are national security and democratic agency. So, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time, you know, national security, because it seems to me fairly obvious that there is a presumptive right, you know, held, for example, by, you know, American citizens. In fact, I should say American residents or British residents or French, you know, residents, that, you know, the codes giving access to weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons, not be disclosed, you know, to all and sundry. I mean, the political agency, you know, argument might not be as obvious as the national security, you know, argument, but I do think it's a powerful interest that we have in political agency, which is protected by the right to secrecy. So secrecy quite often, you know, protects the integrity of democratic procedures and thereby of democratic agency. It also, secrecy protects individual citizens' ability to bring their political plans to completion. So let me give you an example to illustrate both the procedural point and the substantive, you know, point. So procedurally, in a democratic community, we all have an interest in political participation and in there being a formal connection between our individual preferences and political decisions. We all have an interest, in other words, in voting, you know, in the context of national, you know, elections in particular. And so suppose that my interest in casting a vote and in that vote being appropriately counted is important to be protected by a right to vote. But also, let's imagine a right to vote electronically if I'm not able to go to the polling station. Well, that interest is important enough to be protected by a right that the cybersecurity measures taken by my government to ensure the integrity of the online voting system not be disclosed to all and sundry. So that's a procedural, you know, point. But also, you know, substantively, and particularly in the context of foreign relations, secrecy can act as a protective cloak, you know, of courses of action which, if they were made fully public at the outset, would simply not happen. So, for example, the Oslo peace process, you know, which led to mutual recognition by Israel and the PLO in 1993, did start as a back channel process of negotiations under the auspices of the Norwegian authorities. So the role of back channels is to allow officials from political communities in conflict to negotiate with one another, you know, without fear, more immediately without coming to harm. So, you know, these are different ways in which political secrecy protects important, you know, political interests. So once we've established that, I mean, assuming that the argument stands up, you know, to scrutiny, well, then we have to ascertain whether and when and why espionage, which again consists in seeking to procure the secrets as well as defend our own, is morally permissible. Indeed, mandatory.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fabulous. And so the book, once you make that argumentative move that, you know, espionage activities, including the counterintelligence activities, are about protecting secrets, and particularly protecting secrets or acquiring information that could help to thwart basic rights violations. And so if there's a real strong moral reason to protect secrets and to thwart those violations, and if espionage is an indispensable tool for doing those things, it looks like we've got the basis of a pretty robust moral defense, not only of the permissibility, but in, under certain conditions, of the obligatoriness of espionage. But I guess the devil's in the details, right?
That's right. So you've given a wonderfully clear summary, you know, of the you know, of the basic position. So let me now try, you know, to defend the basic position, you know, in a bit more detail. So let's start, you know, with a claim that you know, espionage, for the sake of protecting fundamental moral rights, is morally permissible. So in my work in general, I like to proceed by way of analogies. Now, it's a form of reasoning which is a bit risky because, you know, analogies are not always, you know, illuminating, and they don't always take the place of, you know, more fully developed, you know, arguments. Sometimes, however, they are, you know, illuminating. And so the analogy that I always come back to here, you know, is this. You know, if someone, let's call him Blogs, you know, tries to kill me without justification whatsoever, well, I am morally justified, I'm assuming for the sake of argument, in killing Blogs, you know, in self-defense. Now, if that claim is true, then surely I am morally justified in trying to work out how many guns Blogs has at his disposal. I mean, that surely is not privileged information which Blogs is entitled to prevent me from acquiring, you know, at the point at which, you know, it's absolutely clear to me that he will attempt to kill me with at least some, you know, of those guns. And the point carries over, it seems to me, by analogy to espionage in the context of war. it is not restricted, you know, to war. So as I argue, you know, in the book, you know, if we imagine a country which I call blue, and which embarks on a policy of undermining foreign leaders without warrant, for example, Greens leaders, on the grounds that Green leaders refuse to align themselves to Blue's national interests. And if we imagine that Blue's activities would be seriously harmful, you know, to Green's populations, well, insofar as Blue acts unjustly, Green may justifiably appropriate of information which Blue lacks a right to keep secret about Blue's designs, information which Green needs in order to tailor its particular response. So, you know, the case for permissible espionage, you know, again, you know, with a view solely to protect, you know, fundamental moral rights, more precisely to thwart violations of those rights, the claim that espionage to that end is permissible seems fairly straightforward, you know, to me.
Yeah. But once the argument says that it's permissible in the straightforward way, and I think that you're right about that, then it looks like it's just a short step to it being mandatory in certain kind of ways.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it is. So what I find interesting is that the point has been made before, you know, the point that espionage is morally mandatory, and it's been made very forcefully by, you know, Sun Tzu, whose magisterial, you know, treatise, The Art of War, ends with a chapter on espionage, you know, on the one hand, but also by Thomas Hobbes. My defense of the duty to spy is very different, you know, from Sun Tzu's, you know, and Hobbes's. So for Hobbes, you know, the prince is under a duty to spy because that's his job, you know, as a sovereign. It's in his interest, you know, to do so. He will not survive, you know, as a sovereign under the terms of the contract he has passed with citizens unless he protects, you know, the latter. And his duty to gather the information he needs in order to protect citizens, you know, is grounded, you know, in that prior, in a prudential duty. For Sun Tzu, the sovereign is also under a duty to spy, but very interestingly, in my view, the duty is owed to the sovereign's soldiers and citizens. So the sovereign owes it to his soldiers and citizens to shorten the war, you know, as much as possible. And in order to shorten the war, and indeed also in order to minimize the damage that the war does to them, the sovereign has to, and it's a very strong has to, it's a very strong must, he has to procure the information that he needs. And if spying is the way to do it, well then so be it. In fact, Sun Tzu goes as far as to say in a passage that stands out, you know, in the book, it seems to me, insofar as it has a hint of pathos that you don't find elsewhere, you know, in the treaty, Sun Tzu says, "The prince who does not spy for the sake of his soldiers and subjects is," and here I quote, "devoid of humanity." It's a very strong statement. I don't disagree, you know, with Sun Tzu. I disagree with Hobbes, you know, for reasons articulated earlier when we discussed contractarian morality. You know, Hobbesian morality is contractarian. I don't subscribe, you know, to contractarian morality. Sun Tzu is not a contractarian. And I say this at the risk of, you know, being anachronistic. But nevertheless, you know, to reiterate, this is important. You know, Sun Tzu grounds, you know, the duty to spy, you know, into what the sovereign owes morally at the bar of humanity to his subjects and soldiers. My defense is somewhat different. So I argue that although it is true that Green is under a duty to spy, you know, for the sake of its soldiers and citizens, the duty is not just a duty to ensure that the war is shorter, you know, than it could be, and therefore less harmful to them. It is also rooted, it seems to me, in a duty which a leadership has to its soldiers, citizens, and officials, not to expose them to the risk of committing a serious moral wrong. When we go to war, but the point also applies when we think, for example, about the imposition of economic sanctions or other measures short of war, you know, we impose harms on a wide range of people, not all of whom are our fellow citizens. And there is always a risk that those harms will be wrongful, you know, harm. So there is always a risk, for example, that the military leadership will order, you know, a battalion or, you know, drone pilots to attack targets which in fact are not, you know, legitimate targets. And it seems to me to be a serious dereliction of duty if that military leadership fails to procure information that would tell them that the target is not a legitimate target. It's a dereliction of duty not merely vis-a-vis the direct victims, you know, of the targeting, but vis-a-vis those soldiers, you know, themselves, you know, and the less highly ranked, you know, officials as well. So the duty is owed, you know, by Green, in my recurrent example, you know, to Green citizens and soldiers, as grounded with Sun Tzu in a duty to spare them from the suffering of war or harmful foreign policy decisions. It is grounded in a duty to spare them from the risks of wrongful moral agency. And that risk is overlooked, you know, in the literature. But it is also a duty which Green owes to Blue's innocent civilians, which otherwise, you know, who otherwise would be subject to wrongful harming.
That's fabulous. So I take that to be sort of the core argument. And then the rest of the book is devoted to particular tactics or forms or sites of espionage. And so, you know, I'll just mention to the readers that this is a really, you know, I don't know if comprehensive is the right word, but, you know, there's a lot going on in the book when it comes to the various kinds of tactics. And so we're just going to pick and choose here. So there's a chapter on economic espionage I'm going to set aside for the sake of time, although it was very intriguing. I want to ask about your analysis of deception and then also your analysis of treason. So you argue that there are some forms of deception that are practiced in the course of espionage activities that are defensible, even when they harm those who aren't acting wrongfully. So can you, which again, it was an eye-opening kind of argument for me. Can you run us through the deception argument? And then I want to follow up with the question about treason, which has a similar kind of structure.
That's right. So, yeah. You know, espionage, you know, some definitions, in fact, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, you know, definition is inherently, you know, deceitful. And in fact, Kant, who is one of the very few moral and political philosophers in the history of political thought, apart from Hobbes, you know, to have talked about espionage, loathes, you know, espionage. He dubs it that, I quote, infernal art. Note the contrast, you know, with Sun Tzu. We have two very different kinds of pathos, you know, here. And he loathes espionage, that infernal art, precisely because, you know, to practice espionage is to deceive. Now, there is a very well-developed, really nice, really rich, you know, literature in moral philosophy about Kant's arguments on lying in particular, but more generally, the ethics of deception. And in the book, I avail myself, you know, of that literature in order to, as you said, argue that deception in the service of espionage and counterintelligence is sometimes morally permissible. In fact, I even argue that it is sometimes, you know, morally mandatory. Now, I want to make a broader methodological point, which I was hoping to make at some point, but now I think is a very good time, you know, to do it. In the work that I've done, particularly the work that I did a long time ago on the rights that we have of our own body, more recently the work that I've done on the ethics of war and the ethics of espionage, I conduct, you know, what we in the discipline would call, you know, applied ethics. But the applied ethics I try to do does not simply consist in, you know, taking a framework, so say Kantian arguments, you know, about lying, and simply applying that framework to the applied issue at hand, here espionage. What I try to do is show how, by applying that framework to a specific, concrete, practical issue, we learn things about that framework, you know, in return. So it's a back and forth, you know, move, you know, if you will, you know, between, you know, the foundational and the more practical. And I was very aware of proceeding, you know, in that way, you know, in the chapter on deception, because what I discovered when I started writing the chapter is that, well, of course, you know, we have Kant's famous example of the murderer at the door. So the murderer turns up on my doorstep, asks me to tell him the whereabouts of his intended victim. Am I morally allowed to lie? Kant says I'm not. Most people say I am. Fine. But then when I started thinking about different kinds of deception and different kinds of intelligence, you know, operation, strategies, I discovered that there are many variations on Kant's initial, you know, example of the murderer at the door, which in turn tell us something about the ethics of deception that we might not have been aware of, you know, before. So my hope is that what I say about deception in the book, the deception inherent in espionage and counterintelligence operations, might be helpful when we think about deception in other contexts, you know, as well. So that's the general, you know, methodologic point I wanted to make. Now, I argue, and I'm not alone in this, that intelligence professionals, their leaders, and the citizens on whose behalf they act, who are relevantly similar to the murderer at the door, have forfeited, you know, their claim not to be deceived. Depending on the nature of their wrongdoing, they have forfeited their claim not to be lied to. They have forfeited their claim not to be misled, you know, by implicator. They have forfeited their claim not to have information concealed, you know, from them. These are the easy cases. These are the people who are relevantly similar to the murderer at the door. Now, your question was more probing, more penetrating. It said, well, you know, what about the innocent? You know, what about those who are embroiled, you know, in the deception operation, but who have nothing to do with the war, with the wrongful, you know, foreign policy conducted by their regime? Now, this is, you know, one point at which we learn a lot, you know, from the ethics of war. In that body of literature, there is a well-developed set of arguments which seeks to show that under certain conditions, one may harm the innocent, provided the harm is a foreseen, though unintentional, side effect, you know, of one's actions. And so here I use that body of thought to show that although some innocent people will be harmed by deception operations, so long as the harm is a collateral damage, if you will, you know, of you know, the harm that is done to legitimate targets, then subject to, in particular, constraints of proportionality, the operation of deception is morally justified.
Wonderful. So you've been very generous with your time, and I want to, and we're running short here. But there are two issues that I wanted to invite you to to speak to that come up in the book. One is the treason chapter, and the idea again is that in some cases, you know, that there is a mortal, there is a moral category in your view of mandatory treason. But I wanted also to make sure that we get a chance to talk to about the last chapter of the book, which is about mass surveillance. So I don't know if it's too much of a task to ask you to sort of in the time that we have to sort of say a little bit about treason, but then I want to hear more about the mass surveillance argument. Okay. Is that okay?
No, that's completely fine. So I'll be quick on treason, though. I'm very glad that you ask about this because much of espionage relies on someone from the other side being willing to commit what her side would regard as treason, to commit for our sake what her side would regard as treason and would punish her for it. Indeed, what we would regard as treason if it is done against us, by one of us. So treason really is at the heart, of espionage, which is why I wanted to, to write about it. It is regarded as a heinous, crime, one of the most serious breaches of loyalty in the political domain, that there is. It also goes hand in hand with personal betrayal, the betrayal of one's friends, one's colleagues, one's spouses, one's children. It's a very highly costly thing to do, for the traitor, though I do believe that it is sometimes, at any rate, morally permissible. So, very briefly, to betray is to act against the ties of loyalty which bind us to others, in this particular context, to our fellow citizens. I argue in the book, however, that our loyalty to our fellow citizens or fellow intelligence officers cannot trump the protection of fundamental moral rights. The latter has precedence of the former. We would readily make that claim if we thought about the ties of loyalty that bind members of a crime family, together. Again, by analogical reasoning, we should, be willing to face up, to the possibility that treason is morally permissible for the reason just given. As I also argue in the book, I do believe that there are circumstances in which it is a duty of good Samaritanism, that we are under a duty to do our share to protect victims of violations of fundamental, moral rights. And sometimes, the way in which we discharge that duty is by passing on, to the other side information that that side needs in order to protect those people. We are also under a reparative duty when one is embedded in one state's unjust structures to correct for one's complicity in the moral violations that that regime commits. And again, one way to discharge that reparative duty can sometimes take the form of informational treason. So that's the core of my argument in that chapter.
Very good. Very good. So let's move on to the surveillance, which you find objectionable. But the reason, the reason I thought was very interesting, mass surveillance is objectionable when it is objectionable because it entrenches unfair inequalities.
Yes. Yeah. Good.
Can you tell us a bit about that to wrap up?
Yes. So most people, a lot of people, when they think about what might be objectionable about mass surveillance, will immediately think, oh, well, it's a violation of privacy, as implied by the word, surveil. And I agree that it sometimes is a violation of privacy, though not always. And I want to show that even when it is not, a violation of privacy, we have good reasons to be very deeply concerned about it on grounds of unfair, inequalities. And the argument here goes something like this. Practices of mass surveillance currently rely on algorithmic, inner processes. And there are very good reasons to believe that those algorithmic processes, in turn, are parasitic on existing unfair inequalities. So as a result, the decisions which are made on the basis of those processes worsen, entrench, those inequalities. So the argument, stands up if we can show why and how algorithmic processes are parasitic on existing inequalities. There is a mushrooming, as it were, literature on this at the moment, which I use in the book. The general claim really is this, that algorithms are only as good as the data which they process is, and the data on which they are trained, as well. And so, when the data is incomplete, corrupted, false errors can lead to mistaken descriptions of responsibility. And that data is even more likely to be incomplete, corrupted, false when it tracks, existing inequalities. Let me give you an example. An important issue is that of what algorithms have been trained to identify as a normal pattern and deviations, from that pattern, and of what probabilistic inferences can be drawn, from that information. So one of the most interesting, bits of evidence, as it were, which I found, was a 2017 survey, conducted by the Pew Research Center in the US on patterns of gun ownership. So they correlate with political affiliation, patterns of habitat, gender, and ethnicity. So with that in mind, a white American male who owns several guns, who lives in the rural South, and who identifies as a staunch anti-federal state Republican, will fit very nicely what you may call a normal pattern of gun ownership in that country. A youngish American of Middle Eastern descent who lives in New York and does not record a party political affiliation will not fit. Now, suppose that the algorithm has been trained to identify, not entirely unreasonably, actually, attacks on civilians by young men of Middle Eastern descent as terroristic attacks, whereas attacks by white supremacists are recorded as mass shootings. Well, it's very easy to see why a red flag might be issued if a 30-year-old New Yorker who was born in Morocco suddenly buys guns, hires a truck, and posts anti-West, pro-ISIS messages on Instagram, but not if the messages are posted by a long-term white resident of Colorado who buys a bunch of assault weapons, hires a truck, and posts violent anti-federal and racist messages on Twitter. Now, I would like to hope that, in the light of, recent events, not just in the US, but in Europe as well, intelligence agencies have done some work, on their algorithms. But nevertheless, the example shows what is problematic, at the moment, about practices of mass surveillance, which rely on those algorithmic, processes.
Well, that's a fabulous, a very illustrative example. Cecile, we are out of time, but I really want to thank you not only for joining me for the podcast, but for writing a really fabulous book. It's let me say this. I like all kinds of philosophy books, philosophy books that try to solve problems in new ways, philosophy books that are wrong, but in ways that are innovative and interesting. But yours is a different kind of philosophy book that I like, which is the kind of book that shows me that there's philosophy where I hadn't noticed it before.
Right. Well, thank you very much. That actually means a lot. So really, thank you very much, for this and for having me.
Oh, it's really been a pleasure. Listeners, thank you for joining Cecile and I for our discussion. To remind you, we've been talking about a fabulous new book by Cecile Faube. It's titled Spying Through a Glass Darkly, The Ethics of Espionage and Counterintelligence. And it's just been published with Oxford University Press. I want to thank you, listener, for tuning in to New Books in Philosophy. Bye for now.